we saw a treatment effect. And not only that, so we looked at a pathologic complete response, meaning that the tumors were completely clear of cancer when we removed whatever was left. And that was the interim analysis that was already presented. But we've not been able to prove definitively in other studies that interim pathologic complete response will translate to survival benefit, right? And that's what clinicians, patients, researchers, that's what we care about, is will the patient actually live longer without cancer recurrence, without the other events? And that's what the Matterhorn study demonstrated for the first time.
Welcome to the Oncology Insights Podcast, a weekly show where you'll find cutting-edge insights and everything that's working at the forefront of oncology.
Well, hello, and welcome to this episode of the Oncology Insights Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Dr. Abby Beignot, and we are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in oncology. So get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. My name is Abby Beignot. I'm an interventional pulmonologist at the University of Minnesota. And today we have with us a guest I'm very excited to talk with, Dr. Yelena Janjigian. Dr. Janjigian is a professor and chief of the Gastrointestinal Oncology Service at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She is a physician scientist and leads transformational research and clinical innovation to improve outcomes for patients with GI cancers. Dr. Janjigian earned her bachelor's degree from the University of California, San Diego, and her medical doctorate from NYU School of Medicine. After completing her residency at NYU and Bellevue, she completed her medical oncology fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering. Her research focuses on molecular characterization of gastrointestinal cancers, driving her therapeutic development and bringing new drugs to the clinic. She has published over 140 papers in the New England Journal of Medicine, including something recently we'll talk about today, and the Journal of Clinical Oncology, Lancet Oncology, Lancet, and Nature, with more than 33,000 citations and an H-index of 61. As an elected member of the American Society for Clinical Investigation, Dr. Janjigian serves on the Board of Giants of Cancer Care, Debbie's Dream Foundation, and holds leadership roles in ASCO and AACR. She's also the scientific chair of the European Society for Medical Oncology in 2026. Her research, funded by the NIH, the DOD, and Stand Up to Cancer, has shaped new treatment standards in GI oncology. Beyond research, she's a dedicated mentor, driving innovation and training the next generation of oncology leaders. Dr. Janjigian, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Abby. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, before we get started, I'd like to learn a little bit about how you found yourself in this space. Tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a great in gastrointestinal cancer fighting.
Thank you. Well, I'm an MSK lifer, you would define me. I trained, as you saw, in New York for medical school, and then joined MSK as house staff initially, and then subsequently as a fellow, stayed here throughout my fellowship, and really was mesmerized by the amount of innovation, but also really the unmet need for helping patients with cancer. I was actually going to be a critical care doctor, interventional pulmonologist. That was my dream, putting in central lines and taking care of patients in the ICU at NYU. But as soon as I saw this place, as a house staff, I knew I had to do cancer research. Because of the ability to bring innovation from the lab or, academic sort of space in the clinical trials and so forth straight to the patients. And MSK is such a unique place where things are done so quickly and relatively efficiently that then you can translate and help people all over the world. So I think in somewhere in the parallel universe, I'm working with you and the ICU probably if, I never went to see, and work at MSK, but that's how my path led me to hear. The leadership part was relatively new. I became service chief about 8 years ago, and it's a large group of physicians that I lead. So that's a different path, also parallel to research and innovation. But what really drove me to MSK is that piece, the research and innovation and helping patients.
It's funny because before I settled on pulmonary critical care as a training path, I was considering hematology oncology as well. So I think there are some similarities between those fields. I think being close to people and taking care of them when they're going through a very serious life-threatening illness has a lot of rewards and challenges to that, and probably some similarities. And now I find myself really drawn to taking care of people with lung cancer, which I did a little reading, and it sounds like lung cancer was an area of interest of yours initially as well. Is that right?
That's right. So I've taken a turn from treatment-related myelodysplastic syndrome research to lung cancer. So lung cancer is where I focused most of my work in fellowship. And then when I became a full sort of faculty member and attending, the opportunities were in gastroesophageal cancer, which is where my research in my lab is focused now. And so I pivoted from lung, but lung and acquired resistance to EGFR inhibitors and EGFR mutant lung adenocarcinoma is where I started all of my, really research as an oncologist.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
It seems to me, as we start to understand more about different types of cancers, we are learning more about the similarities between them in addition to the differences, right? And certainly lung cancer is a field now as well that's really being driven by molecular advances and precision medicine and really tailored treatments. And so it's exciting to see that happen in gastroesophageal cancers as well.
Absolutely. Yes. There's so many opportunities across different tumor types. And for young investigators, early career investigators, I think the advice would be to really keep your eyes open for best opportunities for most unmet need. And that was the opportunity for me. So I pivoted from a group in lung cancer to gastroesophageal cancer because it was obvious to me that there were a lot of sort of opportunities there for growth and to establish an independent career. And it worked out.
I think that as you, to be a successful researcher, you always need to be seeing patterns and recognizing how the lane that you're in is really similar in some ways to another lane, and what things you can learn from them and what insights you can bring to a new area of focus as well. So that I think is very, very good advice for early investigators. So to start us off, it sounds like you have a new publication in the New England Journal of Medicine. Could you tell us a little bit about the Matterhorn study and what were the objectives, what kind of patient population? And also, I really want to know how you came up with the name.
Right. Well, so Matterhorn study really focused on a patient population that has not been clearly addressed in immunotherapy trials. So immunotherapy is a class of drugs that we've developed, and it started as oncology in melanoma, but also in lung and other cancers, kidney cancer. And my work in metastatic disease in gastroesophageal cancer, really mine and my collaborators and others, demonstrated that immunotherapy works in late stage disease in patients who present with incurable, more advanced illness. And these are studies that looking at immune checkpoint inhibitors such as nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and other similar drugs by other companies. And so typically in gastroesophageal cancer, we use it with chemoimmunotherapy combination, and the immunotherapy helps augment the body's own response to the cancer to suppress and to develop a T-cell population that will suppress the micrometastasis, which is ultimately what kills our patients. It's not necessarily what we see, but also what develops later on because it's a systemic illness. And so these checkpoint inhibitors take the brakes off the body's immune system and sort of disrupts this fine balance of, protecting the body's own immune system against the anti-tumor response. and helps treat the cancer. For perioperative therapy, meaning in patients with curable disease, however, we have not had immunotherapy available in those patients. And there's a lot of literature to suggest that when the cancer is in the patient still, with the volume of the disease present with a primary tumor and lymph nodes, that's the ultimate, the best time to treat with immunotherapy, because that's, you know, the immune system can be educated based on the tumor bulk that's there. And also practically for our patients, they do better with treatment before surgery while they're still, you know, functionally, because gastroesophageal cancer, you know, the surgery limits the ability of the patient to eat and nutritionally support themselves after surgery, and the tolerance of chemotherapy and immunotherapy may not be as good. So the Matterhorn study is the first study that demonstrated in a global fashion that chemoimmunotherapy can help patients even in non-metastatic setting, even in patients where surgery is the primary goal. And the way that we designed the study is truly it's a global study where historically there were studies that are done in Asia, studies that were done in Europe, studies that were done in North America. But this one was a global study with over 20 countries worldwide enrolling patients. And this was a large study. 948 patients were randomized to receive either chemo or chemoimmunotherapy. And again, as I mentioned, practically we do chemo before surgery, then surgery, and then additional chemo and immunotherapy. So chemoimmunotherapy before surgery, surgery, and then chemoimmunotherapy. This was a placebo-controlled study. So it was randomized, double-blinded, very well-designed and robust design where if we see an effect, which we did, otherwise, you know, spoiler alert, it ended up in New England Journal of Medicine, you know, it was a positive study.
Right, exactly.
For good or bad, negative studies don't end up in New England Journal of Medicine. But we saw a treatment effect. And not only that, so we looked at pathologic complete response, meaning that the tumors were completely clear of cancer when we removed whatever was left. And that was the interim analysis that was already presented. But we've not been able to prove definitively in other studies that interim pathologic complete response will translate to survival benefit, right? And that's what clinicians, patients, researchers, that's what we care about, is will the patient actually live longer without cancer recurrence, without the other events? And that's what the Matterhorn study demonstrated for the first time. We showed that addition of durvalumab, which is an anti-PD-L1 drug, to three-drug FLOT, and FLOT is very modern and a relatively, I would say, you know, intense therapy, the docetaxel, oxaliplatin, and 5-FU, that despite doing a very aggressive regimen with chemo, right? How can you improve on something that's so aggressive and so complete? You're giving them every systemic therapy that's helpful in this disease. But despite that, we were able to improve on survival, event-free survival, and all the other measures, which is pathologic complete response was improved, and disease-free survival in patients who had surgery. So the event-free survival looked at patients who it was an intent to treat, meaning that from the beginning, whether or not you end up having surgery or not, we were going to compare the two cohorts. And the disease-free survival looked at patients who actually completed everything, then had surgery, had a successful surgery. And even in those patients, there was an improvement with durvalumab addition to FLOT. So it was a great, ending to a very long story, yeah, just to give you a sense, you know, it took us about 8 years to get to that point from the beginning of trying to just convince even our pharma partners to do the study, because Merck already had a study, similar study going while we were designing the study, which had, you know, some key differences in the study design. So to start a second study a year later was a big question mark, and we were able to convince them to do it because we had a very different study design in terms of chemotherapy backbone, patient selection, and so forth. You know, and also demonstrate that pathologic complete response can translate to survival benefit, event-free survival benefit, and also that you could do a global study, right? I mean, that was one of the biggest contributions, is that you could do a global study and in a similar patient population across the globe, so that if you're changing practice, you can then take the step forward together, so then you can build on it, right? So what would be the next strategy? People say, well, Matterhorn demonstrated X, Y, and Z. Now we can all do the study together, as opposed to different pieces of the world historically for this disease, you know, approached it in with different studies that often were underpowered to answer a question.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Can you tell me a little bit more about the patient selection? And maybe, you know, I think I can certainly immediately think of the logistical challenges of doing a global study. But are there differences amongst gastroesophageal cancers in different regions of the world? Or how did you manage to kind of bridge that gap?
That's a great question. Yes, and absolutely, that presents a challenge because in the United States, in Europe, what we see in the clinic are mostly gastroesophageal junction tumors. So they start at the very bottom of the esophagus and maybe extend into the stomach just a bit, like the first part of the stomach we call the cardias tumors. And those tumors biologically have a very different behavior. We talked about personalized medicine. So if you sequence into next generation sequencing of those tumors, they are more chromosomally unstable. They have more P53 mutations. They just look and they're really are on the rise worldwide. And they're on the rise worldwide. And people like you and me who are particularly not, you know, we're not particularly high risk for anything. We may or may not have reflux. We're not really, you know, smokers, or we're not obese. We're not. So there is an increase of these cancers worldwide in individuals at under age 50 who are relatively well, we would say. Globally, the cancer that's, endemic, right? Where you say, patients in South Korea or China or Japan are H. pylori tumors that are distal stomach cancer. So they're in the sort of mid or last portion of the stomach. They're not as high up as the cancers that you and I see in the United States. And those are H. pylori driven tumors. They're slightly different in terms of their inflammation pathways, activation, and so forth. And for those patients, you know, the incidence globally is going down because we're so good about, you know, prevention of these H. pylori infections and also screening in worldwide in South Korea and Japan, there's a screening and treatment strategies. So I think putting those together, it's important because for the first time, actually, since I became a gastroesophageal cancer researcher, I see that there is clear representation of gastroesophageal junction tumors, adenocarcinomas, even from sites in Asia. So again, highlighting the importance of understanding these cancers, what drives them, and treating them. For the practical purposes of a clinical trial, you typically include all the patients as long as they're eligible, and then you look at the subgroup analysis, and you try to understand, are there patients that benefit less or more. Within stomach cancer, for example, even we know that there's different histologies, like diffuse gastric cancer may benefit differently than intestinal. As much as we can say about in the subgroup analysis, what we see, even though it's not powered, we see that every subgroup benefited, which is good, which is, you know, it was a good strategy to put all adenocarcinomas under the same trial, enroll them uniformly, make sure they, you know, meet all the inclusion criteria, and then try to decide later on in the further biomarker analysis how else to further stratify these cohorts for future enrollment into clinical trials.
So did the eligibility criteria include any molecular characteristics of the tumors?
We did not because we've mandated tumor assessment for PD-L1 because that's a stratification, but that's a very basic step, right? Because we enrolled patients irrespective of PD-L1 status. PD-L1 is a protein overexpression. It's not, doesn't take very long time. You know, it takes a few just days to get that done. But the problem is it is not a perfect biomarker. And in fact, we know that in a lot of patients, you could be positive and in the same sample negative or vice versa, depending on what test you're using and who's reading it. What's interesting is that in our set, 90% of tumors were PD-L1 positive. So we know that there is some overexpression. But, you know, you were talking about lung cancer earlier. The level of expression in gastroesophageal cancer is not nearly to the same level as in lung cancer. In fact, we're using more criteria of staining in the stroma as opposed to tumor, where the PD-L1 testing is done in lung. And importantly, we saw that patients even with PD-L1 negative tumors benefited. In fact, the NCCN guidelines, you know, right now, we will be approved in the United States for use of this regimen in early stage, even ahead of the FDA approval.
Well, it's so interesting to see how the immune system clearly plays an important role here. For somebody like you, that's not a surprise, right? But I think for maybe many other people, even in medicine, don't often think of cancers as an immune system problem. And so, I recall being a trainee in critical care and, you know, taking care of patients who were dealing with cancer and undergoing treatment, and they had gotten a really strong chemotherapy regimen. And I had this mentor who would say, you know, they're getting jet fuel, basically, like, we're hoping that the patient doesn't die. We're trying to kill the cancer. And so it's so refreshing to see that we now have a bit more of a nuanced approach to try to harness our body's natural powers with the immune system to fight the cancer without having so many side effects.
And we know that certain types of chemotherapies, and I agree, it's toxic stuff. It's toxic to the cancer more so than us, because cancers are more rapidly dividing cells. And so it really attacks a lot of rapidly dividing cells. But there are some chemotherapies that are more immunogenic because of how they kill the cell and the antigens that the cells release during the cell death and what it does to immune microenvironment. So the chemo that we used, FLOT, which is the 3-drug chemotherapy I mentioned, actually may be more immunogenic, even though it's such heavy chemo, than certain others. And, we speculate that that's perhaps what led to a positive study for us, for this cohort of patients.
Can you tell us, were there any unexpected challenges or anything surprising about the trial? Did it go exactly the way you thought it was going to go?
Well, you know, I think like anything else, you can't let perfect get in the way of good enough. But I think as designing the studies, you realize as a medical oncologist, and I'm sure for you in critical care as well, we're so precise about the language we use for management of patients, right? There's standing operating procedures for everything, how you infuse, over what period of time, how you dose reduce anything, et cetera, supporting medications. Surgery, however, is very difficult to control to that degree because, although of course there's some operating procedures, things just are so complex and individualized for each patient, patient's anatomy, how the patient did in the OR, what you find when you open the patient up, that piece we need to really, for the future trials, control even more, because something as simple as a laparoscopy, which is a staging tool that we use to make sure there's no cancer spread to the peritoneum, at a tertiary cancer center like ours and many centers around the world, there you routinely recommend it. It's part of all the guidelines. We know realistically some of the other centers that perhaps have less volume and less support cannot practically offer their every patient a laparoscopy for staging. So as a result, sometimes the patient is enrolled in the study and we didn't mandate the laparoscopies. We said, whatever your standard is for your center, because again, we just want centers to participate. We want to offer patients options, and we want to get as many patients on studies as possible, right? That's the only way we can advance the field. But practically what happens is you have a patient who we think is eligible, then they, at the time of surgery, develop or discover disease that may have not been discovered on imaging, and that is then very disappointing to everybody. And also ends up being, you know, an event that perhaps would have been avoided before. So I think for the future of clinical trials, we need to identify better tools for staging of peritoneal disease and also getting more and more centers, to be high volume, excellent centers of excellence for treatment of this disease, because that piece, the operator dependency of surgery, is probably the hardest challenge for perioperative studies.
You mean you globally, you weren't able to control all the surgeons and make them do exactly what you asked them to do by writing it down on the protocol?
No, I mean, if you look at this, I think our study was the first one. So I got a bunch of surgeons that I really trusted from different centers globally. And they tried to make it just so. And we actually, you know, was the first study to actually write things down. This is what you have to do. But it's very difficult. Once the patient is in the OR, it's really between the patient and the surgeon, right?
Right. So. Yeah. We're teasing our surgery friends. But yes, in the operating room, sometimes either you don't have the local resources or things are just not going the way you expected and you can't do exactly what was planned up front. So, but you bring up an important point, I think, about pragmatic approach to clinical trials and, the tension between doing it perfectly and trying to do it so that the most patients benefit. And then you also get better ability to expand those results and apply them to other people in slightly different situations. If you're enjoying this episode of the Oncology Insights podcast presented by Wisenetics, please remember to like, subscribe, and share it with your friends and family. So I would like to go back to something else you mentioned, unrelated to GE cancers maybe, but you're going to be the scientific chair of the ESMO, is that European Society for Medical Oncology 2026. And I'm wondering for any of our listeners who are aspiring to one day be the scientific chair of a meeting, not to mention a global meeting. What advice do you have? How did you find yourself in that situation? And what kind of skills and tools do you need to do something like that?
Starting early and showing up and coming to meetings, being in the room is probably 50% of it. I think certainly presenting at certain global meetings is critical because people understand that you're not just there for sort of to digest other people's data, but you're also an innovator and you present patients' perspective. Because a lot of these societies really value innovation, but they also value experience and ability to synthesize information and present it and to connect people. I think these societies really depend on having freshest data presented and also mentorship and connections. And I think any of the combination of those three or four factors, but also being present and helpful, often that's how you get your foot in the door. And then it is a lot of work. So I guess be careful what you ask for, especially, you know, there's a inflection point in everyone's career where there's a balance between doing things at home or doing things outside of your institution. And yes, visibility is good, but I think only at the right time in your career, because then it just takes you away from your real work, which is publishing papers and getting your name out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to think about your involvement with societies as being really valuable, but also potentially sometimes you have to pull back a little bit so you can focus on what's happening at home. We talked a little bit about molecular characterization of gastroesophageal tumors, and I'm wondering, I'm certainly thinking about the lung cancer space where, increasingly it's recommended in more and more people with lung cancer, but we're having a hard time getting it done. What is that? The similar landscape in GE cancers where there's just really wide variability in patients, you know, getting that routinely and getting what's recommended?
Absolutely. And forget about worldwide, because I think worldwide there's a huge gap to what the patients have access to, even some of these, you know, because I travel and I do a lot of, engagement with local experts in countries like Armenia or Vietnam or where there's a lot of education, a lot of the knowledge, a lot of the doctors may be trained even abroad. And then when they come, there's this, well, we can't even get these drugs for our patients. In the United States, there's also a huge gap. And I think some of the gap is this nihilistic approach where the patients come in, and I'm sure in lung cancer, it's the same. It is actually, they can be quite ill. And it's, you know, increasingly the healthcare is just so complicated where the patient gets, diagnosed at one place and then comes to see you in another place, and you can barely get enough unstained slides to do any testing. And so, and the doctors are asked to do so much in such a short period of time that it just becomes daunting. And I think that's why having a support network of patient advocacy, understanding, and having for patients to have a voice so that it's a focused, asks, as a, and also seeking out experts. I can tell you, I will stay late in clinic, or I'll engage my nurses, my, you know, fellows and so forth to get this testing done, because gastroesophageal cancer is all that I do. And I understand how important it is to do the testing. But, you know, another doctor who perhaps sees a bit of breast cancer, or lymphoma, or leukemia, you know, they only see gastroesophageal cancer once or twice a month. For them, it's even harder to get some of the molecular testing done or, ordered or requested. And so, but in the United States, the real world data suggests that only about 40% of patients get any biomarker testing done in this disease, which is really not good. And considering we have so many resources and so many available drugs.
Do you have any resources that you recommend or that you go to for patients with GE cancers to educate themselves and to be able to advocate for themselves? Like you said, to make sure that they're kind of helping their healthcare team to do what is we know is going to help them.
Well, so what I find is that by the time patients seek out these resources, it's a lot of times it's when they're already very ill, or it's usually the loved one, because they're just really desperate and scared and feel like they need to do something. So a lot of the patient advocacy groups get the requests when the patient is really not doing well, right? And what I find is that in early stage, right, even in like the patients that would normally get put on a Matterhorn study for early stage disease, or even some of our first line patients, when the patient first gets diagnosed with cancer, I find that's when a lot of the difference in care can, and how you do on your first line therapy is really impacts on how long you're going to live, even with metastatic disease, right? So that first step, who you see first, matters a lot. And I find that because it's just so scary and complex that patients don't even reach out to patient advocacy. That's why I never turn down an opportunity to do one of these podcasts or just be visible online, because a lot of times people just Google us and find us that way. And MSK is a great opportunity and resource, certainly, because we have regional network locations all over New York, New Jersey, Long Island areas. So it does offer patients an entry criteria, and then, you know, they can often see us through telehealth, and I can enroll them on those studies at Baskin Ridge or Bergen or Monmouth County and so forth.
Yeah, I think you're right. And at the time of diagnosis with a serious cancer, people are overwhelmed. And then you said that even the healthcare team is overwhelmed with all the stuff that needs to be done right away, staging and molecular characterization. Do you have any advice for people or their caregivers, their loved ones who might be diagnosed with a GE cancer? What should they be making sure they get done in those early moments?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's this emotional reaction. I have a cancer diagnosis. I need to act fast. And, you know, I think what is important to understand is that there is time. I would sort of take a moment and regroup and ask questions and see what the doctors are recommending are, you know, probably a good option. But if you want to get a second opinion or talk to someone else, ask for that option. And, you know, I always ask my patients, how did you find me? And often it's not the doctors that refer them, but it's the staff in the office. They'll say, you know, someone handed me your name and said, you have to go see this person before you make any decisions. And that's okay. People realize this is an orphan disease, right? And nuances in the care really often make all the difference. Patients in my clinic, for example, are able to get care and sometimes we don't know if it's going to be the right, you know, the but for, you know, all these immunotherapy trials, some of the other targeted, what we were able to offer patients as part of a clinical trial, the rest of the world will be getting just now, right? And they had access to it 5 years ago. So I think having that option is always good, and realizing you have time. And also, don't always assume quality, you know, because I think there's a lot of this. Well, my doctor referred them to you. I think they're probably good enough. You know, there's different level of care that's involved in a cancer center that's focused on cancer, right? And this is an orphan disease. I hate to say this, but it's not. There's not enough NIH funding directed toward it. You know, industry is just now pivoting to because they understand it's such a big unmet need, and we can quickly get answers and get new drugs to patients, which is exciting.
Yes, I definitely see that parallel with lung cancer. I think that's really great advice. You're right. People are coming into this and they have a sense of urgency, but actually picking the right treatment and getting the right treatment plan in place is definitely worth taking the time to make sure that you've got someone who knows the best and newest when it comes to this type of cancer. Well, I want to thank you for your time today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close out?
Yeah, this is a great resource to our patients, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Janjigian, and that concludes another episode of the Oncology Insights podcast presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast to stay updated on future episodes, and if you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review. Your feedback is very invaluable. Until next time, this is Dr. Abby B. from the Oncology Insights podcast signing off.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.